And a little something different for you today. Instead of opening with a joke, I want to share with you something that I found. And what these are letters written by little children telling their parents that they're running away from home. And they're all pretty short and sweet. Dear Mom and Dad, I ran away. I'll be home soon. Love, Joey. P.S. It's all Mom's fault. This one's a little formal. Dear Mother, I am running away from home. Don't call Mrs. Mandel or the police. Goodbye, and I mean it, for a short time. Don't bother looking for me. Love from your ex-son, Jeffrey. Dear ex-mother and dad, do not call the FBI or the police. Police is spelled P-L-I-E-C-E. I will be back on Wednesday. The reason I have done this is because you are mean. And he signs it formally with a surname, Sam Sounds. Dear Mommy, I think I may have to run away sometime and get a new life and other stuff. And I think I'll have enough money and a new job. I'm sad I have to go, but I'm having a rough day at school and other times. I'm going to have to go on Saturday. Please help me pack and get a new mom. If they don't want me, take me to the orphanage. I love you and I'll miss you. Sincerely, Isabel. Dear Mom and Dad, I'm not happy with how you speak to me. I'm running away, by Claudia. Dear everyone, I am leaving your home. I know Jerry and Dad love me, but I know Mom doesn't. Thanks for letting me use your house these long 8 years. I can see Mom doesn't want us, mostly me. So I'm leaving this letter to Jerry and Dad, and maybe Mom. Okay, Mom, too. Jerry may have my chair, and Dad may have my room, and Mom could have the thing I sleep with. I got to go now. I'll see you one day, so bye. And it's signed, almost your little girl, Savannah. And I just had to include this last one. Dear Mom and Dad, I am running away because you think I farted when I didn't. P.S., you are mean. Well, our topic today is come out wherever you are. We're all familiar with that when we played hide and seek as kids. And it's apropos for this talk, along with these letters, in my opinion, because today we're going to talk about the story of Jonah. And it's a really fascinating story in so many ways. And it still occupies a very important part in a lot of Christian and even Jewish traditions. And we're all kind of familiar with the story, and there's always been this debate for centuries, is this something that really could have happened? So I will share with you that most biblical scholars, including a lot of Jewish theologians, tend to regard this as midrash, which means it never really happened, but the lesson in the story is so powerful that it's a story that's kept and held in very high esteem. So let me just summarize the story as best and as quickly as I can. One day, Jonah, a fine Jewish fellow, is just being Jonah, and God comes along and kind of disrupts his life. Because he says, Jonah, I have a job for you. I want you to go to the city of Nineveh, which was the capital of Assyria. And I want you to deliver a message to the people of that city that they need to get their act together. They need to turn things around. I don't like the way they're behaving. And if they don't, I'm going to wreak havoc on that city. I'm going to level the city and destroy all of the people in the city. And Jonah hears this, and he wants absolutely nothing to do with this mission. So if Nineveh is in that direction, Jonah heads out in that direction. And instead of going to Nineveh, he heads for the city of Tarshish. Now, it's kind of interesting. The actual physical distance between those two cities is 2,500 miles. So you can see the intent that Jonah had to escape what he was being called to do and evade and hide from the presence of the Lord. So he starts out by going down to the city of Joppa, where very conveniently there is a ship that is scheduled to sail to Tarshish. And very conveniently, there's room for him on board. And very conveniently, he has the money to pay for this trip. So he boards the ship, and he goes down to the hold of the ship, and he goes to sleep. And the ship sets sail, and very soon, a big storm comes up and just starts tossing this vessel all over the seas. And the crew is really scared and nervous, understandably so, and the captain as well. And the captain goes down to the hold of the ship, and he wakes Jonah up, and he says, "Jonah, what's with the sleeping? Can you please pray to your God asking for help in this situation?" Meanwhile, the crew was busy drawing lots to see who was responsible for this mess that they were in, and it all pointed to Jonah. And so they confront him, and they say, "Who are you, and what are you about?" And Jonah tells them, "My name is Jonah. I'm a Hebrew, and I worship the Lord God of heaven, the maker of land and sea." And when he's through telling a story about what he was supposed to be doing, they are even more frightened than ever because they realize that this guy is trying to escape the presence of the Lord. And Jonah tells them, "I know that I'm responsible for what's going on right now. The only thing I could tell you is you should throw me overboard and all of this will go away." And they're reluctant to do that. And they still try to paddle their way, row their way back towards the land, but the storm just keeps growing in intensity. So again, very reluctantly, they pick up Jonah, they toss him overboard, he goes down into the sea, and there he's swallowed up by a giant fish and goes down into the belly of the fish. And while he's there, he prays. The whole second chapter of this short story is his prayer that he prays while in the belly of that fish, when he's enveloped in what must have been total darkness and solitude. And in his prayer, he begins to recount how everything that he is and everything that he has and everything that there is, period, is all because it was provided by God. And so his prayer ends up being this incredibly beautiful psalm of thanksgiving. And the Lord hears his prayer, and he causes the fish to spit Jonah out onto the shore. Then, of course, the fish went off and told his friends, "You should have seen the one that got away." And once again, God comes to Jonah, and he says, "I'm sorry, but you still got to do this mission thing." So he goes off to Nineveh, very, very reluctant, but he goes. And he spends 3 days crossing through that city, telling people, "You need to get it together, because if you don't, all heck is going to break loose." And then something really surprising happens. They listen. They get the message. They hear and they repent. All of the people, right up to and including the king. And as a result, the city is spared. Well, when Jonah learns of this, he is not a happy camper. He can't believe that after all of the trouble that he had to go through and everything that he had to put up with, the city is actually going to be spared. And so he makes no bones about telling the Lord about how unhappy he was with the Lord's decision, and he goes into a snit. And he just sets up camp someplace for the purpose of brooding. And at first the Lord feels compassion towards him and causes a bush to grow up over to provide shade for him and provide him with comfort. But Jonah is parking there a little bit too long and just continues to mope and to brood. And so God causes a worm to come along and damage the bush and has it go away. And now Jonah is in the pure sunlight and suffering, and he plays the martyr card. I'd be better off dead than I am alive. And so the Lord gets in his face and says, hey, you need to understand, this isn't all about you. There were 120,000 people in that city doing the best that they can, struggling because they don't know their right from their left, but they listened, and they are worthwhile. This is really a classic book. Jonah is regarded as one of the minor prophets, and this is a book of prophecy. But it might be better classified as political satire. The story remains very strong in the Jewish tradition, and it's frequently used at Jewish services and is read on every Yom Kippur as a reminder to the people of God's incredible loving capacity for forgiveness. And then interestingly also, this story is also retold in the Quran. Before looking at the metaphysics of the story, I want to take a look at it from its cultural and historical view. This writing, what the author really intended here, was to administer the whole story in a spirit of political criticism. And so the events of the story probably were intentionally exaggerated or far-fetched in order to make a point. And historically, this story was written after the end of the Babylonian exile, when the Jews came back and they began to reestablish their nation. This was after the time of Ezra and a whole new dedication to the law. And so it really was kind of a golden period in the Jewish nation's history. And so the story was written to oppose Jewish nationalism that was characteristic of the time, along with the attitude of Jewish exclusivity. And so Jonah, like most of the Jews at that time, absolutely did not want to have anything to do with, and probably actually hated the idea of salvation for the Gentiles. And as I was researching this talk, and I came to realize this, you know, the question popped into my head, does this bear any resemblance to what's going on in our country today? You know, are we being called? Is there some sort of a metaphorical message that's being sent out to us? And if there is, are we hearing it? Are we heeding it? Or are we, too, choosing to go off to Tarshish in another direction? On a metaphysical level, we've all been in Jonah's shoes. On a personal, individual level, all of us at one time or another are called to the Nineveh within. And sometimes we resist that call out of fatigue or perhaps fear. I have a close friend, a tennis buddy. Every time I got together with this guy, which was at least once a week, all he did was complain about his marriage and about his wife. And this would go on forever. And after about a year of this, I finally said to him, have you ever thought about counseling? And his response was, she was not going to go to counseling, believe me. She wants nothing to do with anything like that. And I said, very gently and kindly as I could, I wasn't talking about her. I was talking about you. And he said, me? Why should I go to counseling? And I said, well, let's see. You've already made it very clear that she's not open to or about to change in any way. This isn't something you could call the police about or the fire department. It seems to me that the only person left in this equation that's empowered to do anything is you. And it was just met with silence at that time. Your Nineveh is whatever pulls you out of your comfort zone. Your Nineveh is that place, be it physical, psychological, emotional, or spiritual, it's that place you really don't want to go. Your Nineveh is everybody and anybody that has ever deeply hurt you and is now somebody that God wishes to send a message to. Your Nineveh is your pain, your discomfort, your sense of danger about anybody or anything that you dislike and maybe even hate, but that God deeply loves. Jonah understood that he was the reason that the storm ravaged that boat. When we hear a call, when we know that there is something for us to do and we choose to go in another direction, we understand that we are the cause of that storm. We may blame other people and we may blame God, but deep down inside, we get it. Because it's a result of a decision or a series of decisions in which we have tried to create distance, space, separation between ourselves and God, and or we have tried to just deny that reality, that spiritual reality of our very own Christ essence. There's a fascinating aspect to this story. On four occasions in this story, Jonah goes down to or goes down into something. He goes down to the city of Joppa. He goes down to the hold of the boat. When he's thrown overboard, he goes down into the sea. And when he's swallowed up by the fish, he goes down into the belly of that fish. And a couple of weeks ago, we talked about whenever there's an upward consciousness, that there's some kind of upward movement in the story. And this is just the converse of this. You know, there's a symbolism in terms of going down into something. And we tend to think that once we've arrived at a certain consciousness, the only way to go is up, or maybe at worst, stand still. But that's not true. We are absolutely capable of making a decision to become less conscious, grow more baser, whatever the proper word is, in our thinking. And there's always a strong temptation to do this if we perceive that in some way, shape, or form, it's going to make our life a little bit easier, perhaps a little less frightening. We also know that when this is going on in our lives, it very much affects those around us, just the way the sailors were affected in this story and got pulled in and roped in because of Jonah's decision. Whenever we create a storm in our life, it's sad and it's disappointing and it's unfortunate, but so often it causes rain to pour down on those that are near and dear to us. And it affects people that are marginal in our lives as well. We don't realize what an incredible influence we have on other people, positive or negative, based upon who we are, what we do, and how we show up in a given situation. You want a grand example? Every year in this world, thousands of children starve to death or are killed by collateral damage because our governments refused to make that trip to Nineveh. Think about a child that's in a home where the parents are constantly going at one another and the turmoil that is in that child's life. In my relatively speaking short time in Unity, I have witnessed at least two churches brought to its knees because people in those churches have decided to draw that line in the sand instead of recognizing that shared bond and how we're joined, not just at the hip, but we're joined together at the heart by virtue of that universal oneness and that Christ that dwells within. And we so often don't want to hear that story and that call to Nineveh, and we head off into the opposite direction. And what about the fish? I want to go back to my tennis buddy. Shortly after I had that confrontation with him, and I'm not responsible for this, he took seriously ill and required emergency surgery and spent 3 days, ironically, 3 days in intensive care before being moved to a regular room. And I went to visit him when he went to a regular room, and he said, I have to tell you, all that time that I was in intensive care, I had a lot of time to myself, a lot of time to think, and I decided that nothing's going to get better in my life until I decide to make it better. And when I get out of this situation, I'm going to try to figure out and put the pieces together and do absolutely everything that I can to make it work. And what this has to do with the fish is, God did not have Jonah swallowed up by the fish as a punishment. Jonah, just like a child sometimes, really needed a timeout. He really needed to be placed in that situation of solitude, where really all that he had was his own heart and his own mind and his own devices. And it's the same thing with us. We need to be swallowed up by a fish on occasion. And if we don't do it willingly by an ongoing practice of prayer and meditation, it's invariable that you're going to get into trouble at some point and be forced into that situation. And when it happens, it's just an incredible gift. Because it's the only way really that we have of determining what is ours to do and then mustering up that strength and that courage that is so necessary for us to get it done. And then comes the fun part. The part that is so hard for us to deal with. In the story, Jonah is again reminded that he has to go off to Nineveh and preach the message, and he does so reluctantly, but he also does so with his own agenda. You see, he thinks that this is all a foregone conclusion, that the city is going to be destroyed and all the people are going to be killed. And he thinks that what he's doing is just perfunctory, something to set the stage for what is really going to happen. And when it doesn't happen, again, he is really disturbed. And how many times do we experience something like that in our own life? You know, we have this thing of, dear Lord, I did everything right. I don't see how this could not have turned out the way I wanted it and the way I was expecting it to turn out. You know, I worked at this job for 35 years, breaking my bones in my back, and they laid me off. What is this about? I've made a practice of eating right, exercising regularly. How could I be sick like this? I've put everything I had into this relationship. I can't believe that you're leaving. I've never cheated anybody out of a nickel. It's just not fair that I'm struggling like I am financially. God basically responds to Jonah's anger by telling him, again, you got to realize that sometimes it's not all about you. And again, he tells him, there's 120,000 people in that city, and listen to the language of the scripture. These people didn't know their right from their left. And the point is, yeah, maybe you're smarter. Maybe you're wealthier. Maybe you think you are of a higher consciousness. But it doesn't matter, because those people mattered. Those people counted. We all have this thing that whenever something happens in our life. I mean, we all know that the earth revolves around the sun. But we always have these times. In fact, most of the time, we really think the world revolves around us. And when something takes place in our life, whether it's good or bad or indifferent, our brains are quick to go to that spot of, how does this relate to me? How does this affect me? What is this about? Am I in trouble here? Am I in danger? Do I need to be careful? Or my favorite, geez, I wonder what's in it for me. There's nothing wrong with this. This is something very natural. Our brains are wired like that for a purpose. It's a method of survival. And in that sense, it's a really good thing. But when we hear or see that message in which we are called to do something, it's not the time for us to start heading toward Tarshish. Tarshish, by the way, metaphysically, represents that part of us that is cold and calculating and intellectual. It's that part of us that tries to prevent us from that feeling aspect of our lives, that compassionate, mystical aspect of our lives. And so it's okay to bring it home and say, how does this relate to me? But always look if there's maybe not a secondary message there. I opened this talk this morning reading those letters to you from children that were running away from home. And I would like to close the talk by giving you an assignment to consider. And I'm really serious about this. As soon as possible, so you don't lose it out of your minds. Grab a pen and paper. Write a letter to God. Tell God, reflect upon those times when you ran away. And in that letter, tell God, Lord, the reason that I ran away was. Or if there's some situation in your life in which you are currently evading something that is yours to do and you're running away, dear Lord, the reason that I'm running away is. And don't hesitate to express it in terms of what you're feeling in your guts. It's not an intellectual exercise. It's an exercise of allowing your presence to acknowledge the presence of Spirit in the world and the presence of their Christ deep down within you. And so I have only two things that I absolutely would recommend be part of your letter. And the first is that you close it with a sincere expression of love. And after it's done, include a very, very important P.S. Thank you.